Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 341, titled The Ties That Bind, Part 2. This is being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001. This program is going to continue discussion and analysis of the attacks of 9-1-1, 2001. Other programs in this series are dealing with that subject are For the Record program 325 through 340 and counting. These broadcasts are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com, and you can visit their website for a meticulously annotated description of each program listing the sources for each point of information at www.spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs online, for those of you who are online. And you can visit their website for streaming programs and more recent broadcasts at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio from another longer URL that has links from both a For the Record section of the Spitfire website that has the annotated descriptions of each program, and from the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website for WFMU, which has the streaming programs. If some of the supplemental discussion for the points of information that I'm about to present are not clear to you, and I can appreciate that that might be the case due to the nature of the analysis, please contact Spitfire if you're not online. Avail yourself of the Spitfire website for the annotated descriptions of each program, listing the sources with each point of information, and take advantage of what WFMU has given us and visit their websites, and in particular all of the programs that they have aired so far on the 9-1-1 attacks are streaming. In For the Record program 325 and 326, I dealt with the late John P. O'Neill, who was the FBI official in charge of the investigation into the Bin Laden organization. He quit the FBI in July of 2001. We also dealt with Mr. O'Neill. In For the Record programs 336 and 337, John P. O'Neill, according to a recent book published in France called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite, Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, was frustrated actively in his investigation of the Bin Laden organization and quit the FBI in July of 2001 because of that frustration. John O'Neill attributed that active frustration to the profound Saudi support for Osama bin Laden and for the American corporate connections to that milieu through the petroleum industry. And I speculated in For the Record 325 and 326 that, in fact, John O'Neill was doubled on by other elements within the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement apparatus loyal to the Bush faction of the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, related elements, and through that milieu, the underground Reich. And in particular, in For the Record program 325, I reprised an element that I presented in For the Record 322 concerning the theft of a briefcase that John P. O'Neill had with him in Tampa, Florida. This theft took place in the summer of 2000, and the material that was stolen had detailed information about every counterintelligence and counterterrorist operation in the New York City area, including the detailing of manpower for each operation. The article that I'm about to read dovetails, in my opinion, with that theft. And by the way, that the information about that theft was from the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle of August 9th of 2001. Bearing in mind the theft of that briefcase and my speculation that that theft may very well have been connected with the 2000 and the 911 attacks, bear in mind that John O'Neill, after quitting the FBI, was hired as the security director for the World Trade Center in August of 2001 and then was killed in the attacks the following month, thereby silencing him from any active testimony he might have given about the events. The San Jose Mercury News from last Sunday, that being Sunday, December 9th of 2001, has the following story by Pat Milton of the Associated Press. It's Dateline New York and headlined, "Atta was in New York as early as June of 2000. The article reads in part as follows. Mohammed Atta, apparent ringleader of the September 11th terrorist hijackings, rented rooms in New York City in the spring of 2000 with another hijacker, a federal investigator said. Authorities learned of their stay in New York while retracing the hijacker's steps before the attacks, according to the investigator, who spoke on condition of anonymity. Investigators confirmed that Atta and the second man rented rooms in Brooklyn and the Bronx and are trying to identify anyone who might have supported them. Atta's trail in Brooklyn began with a parking ticket issued to a rental car he was driving, said a senior Justice Department official who also spoke on condition of anonymity. Neither official would elaborate on Atta's activities in New York or identify the hijacker who accompanied him. The question I have concerning this article specifically is, since Atta apparently, according to the information presented here, got a parking ticket issued in Brooklyn in the spring of 2000, this issued to a rental car he was driving, Atta obviously knew that law enforcement and potentially counterintelligence officials may have been aware of his presence in New York City. What I am wondering is whether the theft of the briefcase in which the late John P. O'Neill, in charge of the bin Laden investigation for the FBI and killed in the 9-1-1 attacks, I wonder if the information in that briefcase detailing the every counterintelligence and counterterrorist operation in New York City, and including the personnel allocations for same, I wonder whether the theft of that briefcase may have been conducted in order to see if Atta's trail in Brooklyn had in fact been picked up as a result of this parking ticket. Now, obviously, this is a speculative element, but it is pretty apparent that Atta must have known about the parking ticket and about the possibility that this may have compromised the impending operation. I wonder whether my speculation, obviously I believe this is the case, but I cannot prove this. I wonder about my speculation engaged in For the Record 322 and in 325 and 326. I wonder about my speculation about the theft of that briefcase being directly connected to the 9-1-1 attacks and having been conducted by elements that were doubling on John P. O'Neill in conjunction with the terrorists and the Bush/Petroleum/Underground Reich section of the intelligence community, that element that I have referred to as a fascist fifth column operating on behalf of what I call the Underground Reich. I wonder if that parking ticket picked up by Mohammed Atta and a company in Brooklyn in the spring of 2000 might have been the reason for the theft of the briefcase from John O'Neill in the summer of 2000. In For the Record 325 and 326, I speculated about this fifth column and the very real possibility that, in fact, for all of its mistakes, for all of its blunders and all of its misdeeds, that, in fact, the FBI might be in a state of active subversion by this fifth column and by the Underground Reich, a possibility that is not to be too readily dismissed. And in conjunction with that admittedly speculative element, consider the following article. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, November 6th of the year 2001. This is an article by Eric Lichtblau of the LA Times, Dateline Washington, headlined, FBI turns down hundreds of ex-agents offering help. Subtitled, Investigation. The refusals fuel tension among alumni. The CIA welcomes such aid. This reads in part, despite an enormous drain on its manpower, the FBI is turning down help in its dual terrorism and anthrax investigations from some of its most experienced supporters, former agents. Skipping down, quote, the response we got was, thanks but no thanks, unquote, said retired FBI agent Larry C. Upchurch, a 28-year veteran who is pushing the FBI to reconsider its position. Quote, I'm a little bit perplexed. I don't want to carry a gun or a badge. I just want to help. Unquote. I would note that the late John O'Neill was very popular with the FBI, and his loss, his martyrdom in the 9-1-1 attacks, which I believe was accomplished quite possibly with the aid of this fifth column, I wonder whether perhaps the FBI is turning down these ex-agents' help, despite the fact that they are, by their own assessment, stretched in terms of manpower. I wonder if this is taking place because of the subversion and the deliberate delivering of the Bureau that I have speculated about in the past. Note that in For the Record programs 310 and 325, I've dealt with my belief, and it obviously is an opinion, that the appointment of Robert Mueller to head the FBI, a former Bush senior Justice Department investigator or prosecutor in charge of the BCCI, Pan Am 103, and Noriega investigations, all of which would have gone back to the Iran-Contra affair and the elder George Bush. The BCCI investigation, had it been investigated, would have gone to the Bin Laden family and the partial capitalization of George W.'s first oil company by James R. Bath, the North American business representative for the Bin Laden family, and quite possibly through the aforementioned Mr. Bath, the Bin Laden family itself may have been the capitalization agent, at least in part, for George W.'s first oil company. Now, in connection with the 911 attacks, I want to caution that this is an extremely complex event, and despite the very important element, the primary importance of the petroleum industry here, and in that regard, the ties that bind, hence the title of the program, I want to caution against oversimplification. This is a very complex event, and to make a very long story very short, people should think of a couple of paradigms. First of all, the mafia. How they will perhaps do one a favor, and then having compromised one with that favor, then they move in on your situation and or use that favor to gain a cover, journalistic and legal cover, for other activities. And also in that regard, this advisory. Think Machiavelli. Think about the prince and the tactics advocated by Niccolo Machiavelli. And the ties that bind is the nature of the focal point here. I've spoken in the past about one of the ties that binds, and this binds key elements of the Bush administration to the petroleum industry, to the Saudi power elite, including the Bin Laden family. This also binds both Georges Bush to the Bin Laden family through business connections. The elder George Bush is heavily involved with this company, the Carlyle Group, and the younger George Bush, George W. Bush, the current president, sits on the board of directors of a Carlyle subsidiary called Cater Air, which caters to airline companies. And as some people may be flying back for the holidays, just think about the fact that the catering for your flight may be done by a company financed in part by the Bin Laden Group, and on whose board of directors George W. sits. Happy holidays and happy landings. An article about the Carlyle Group appeared on the front page of the business section of the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, December 2nd of 2001. This is an article by David Lazarus. It's headlined, CalPERS and Carlyle Profit from Afghan War, and it reads in part as follows. As America's military involvement abroad deepens, profits are increasing for the Carlyle Group, and it turns out for thousands of California civil servants, skipping down. Carlyle counts among its chieftains former Defense Secretary and ex-Deputy CIA Director Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of State James Baker, and most notably former President George Bush. Until October, the Carlyle Group also maintained financial ties with none other than the family of Osama bin Laden, but those links were severed when it was agreed that the relationship was becoming a tad embarrassing for all concerned. What is not well known is that Carlyle's profits also benefit the 1.2 million members of the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, the largest public pension fund in the United States. CalPERS has about $730 million invested in Carlyle itself and in various Carlyle funds. It owns 5.5% of the Carlyle Group in a minority equity stake and has an option to double that holding during the next 2 years. Quote, "We're not too keen on discussing anything related to the political nature of the people at Carlyle," said Pat Mocht, a spokeswoman for the fund. But she noted, quote, "Carlyle is among the top five largest private equity partners of CalPERS." I would note, ironically, and not in any relevant sense, but Mocht, that woman's last name, is the German word for power, and it's derived from Machiavellian. Again, that's simply an amusing coincidence and an aside under the circumstances. What is neither amusing nor an aside is the fact that business connections of the type that the Bush family maintains to the Bin Laden family, and the connections connecting luminaries like James Baker, the former Secretary of State, whose proteges many of the key negotiators for the Palestinians were. People like Hanan Ashrawi and Saeb Erekat were coached in the latest public relations techniques by the Bush/Petroleum faction of the Central Intelligence Agency. They were dubbed by the company, quote, Baker's Dozen, unquote. And I would note not only the breakdown of the talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the fact that Arafat himself, not only a protege of SS Colonel and Commando and Odessa operative extraordinaire Otto Skorzeny, but a distant cousin of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, himself an operative on behalf of the SS and the Third Reich in its pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. But I would note that Yasser Arafat, despite the fact that he was going to get 95% of the occupied territories back, get recognition for a Palestinian state, and get to share Jerusalem as a capital, he walked out of the talks the same day that petroleum man Dick Cheney, the former Secretary of Defense of the elder George Bush, was appointed to be the vice presidential candidate for George W. Bush. I would also note in that regard, although we don't have time to go into it in these programs, it will be reprised in a future broadcast. The Israeli right wing also has not only a fascist heritage and numerous fascist connections, but it also has very strong ties to the American right. A number of programs dealing with that. Miscellaneous Archive shows M30, M58, For the Record programs 94 and 262 go into some of those connections. And I would also note that one of the For the Record shows, I've forgotten which off the top of my head, but it's one of the programs called Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. It's in the 130s, deals with an allegation in the book Gideon's Spies that Monica Lewinsky, who obviously helped to compromise Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky herself had ties to an element of Israeli intelligence. So that there are elements of the far right, which the international fascist community and what I call the underground Reich, that have ties not only to the most extreme element of the Palestinian movement and extreme or Islamo-fascist elements in other parts of the Middle East and the Islamic world, they also have a profound connection going back decades and through the present to the Israeli right wing, which took power as a result of the breakdown of the Camp David talks in July of 2000. Ehud Barak had staked his political future on successful negotiations, and Ariel Sharon, with documented connections to the fascist element in the Zionist movement, took power as a result of the breakdown of those negotiations, which might have gotten Al Gore elected, riding on Bill Clinton's foreign policy coattails under the circumstances. I deal with that element of speculation in For the Record Program 334 and 336. Now, speaking of the ties that bind, and once again I want to caution against oversimplification in this, one of the elements that could perhaps be considered the medium through which the infectious agents of Islamo-fascism and Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, such as bin Laden, have moved, is through the petroleum industry and the connections of the petroleum industry not only to the Saudi Arabian power elite, but also through that to the American power elite, the petroleum industry, and what I call the underground Reich. And there was a very important article dealing with Al-Qaeda and the frustration of an attempt by the Sudanese government to share its information about Osama bin Laden with the Clinton administration. This is carried in the issue of the January 2002 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is an article by David Rose titled The Osama Files, and it reads in part as follows. From the autumn of 1996 until just weeks before the 2001 attacks, the Sudanese government made numerous efforts to share this information, meaning the information about Osama bin Laden, with the United States, all of which were rebuffed. On several occasions, senior agents at the FBI wished to accept these offers, but were apparently overruled by President Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, and her Assistant Secretary for Africa, Susan Rice, both of whom would not comment for this story after repeated requests for interviews, skipping down. How could this have happened? The simple answer is that the Clinton administration had accused Sudan of sponsoring terrorism and refused to believe that anything it did to prove its bona fides could be genuine. At the same time, perceptions in Washington were influenced by CIA reports that were wildly inaccurate, some the result of deliberate disinformation. The problem was, quote, inadequate vetting and analysis by the CIA of its own product, unquote. That the assessment, by the way, of Tim Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y, the last U.S. ambassador to Sudan. And skipping down again, of Osama bin Laden's presence in Sudan. Osama bin Laden, his four wives, his children, and numerous, quote, Afghan Arab, unquote, followers who had helped drive the Soviets from Afghanistan went to Sudan from Saudi Arabia early in 1991. Now let's hear what he was doing in Saudi Arabia. Speaking of the fact that Al-Qaeda, the bin Laden-headed terrorist organization, had been founded 2 years before he moved to Sudan, Al-Qaeda, with its secretive structure and oath of allegiance to bin Laden, had been founded 2 years earlier. In Sudan, however, much of bin Laden's energy went into business. A contract funded by the Saudis to build the airport at Port Sudan, agricultural products, and Al-Hijra, a joint venture with the Sudan government to build a 185-mile road northward from Khartoum. Abu Ibrahim, the Iraqi engineer who became Al-Hijra's CEO, says bin Laden took a strong interest in the project's technical details. In bin Laden's large house, in an affluent part of Khartoum, they spent hours together discussing which diggers, graders, and other items the firm ought to buy. On his visits to the site, Ibrahim says, bin Laden showed, quote, he knew how to drive every piece of machinery, unquote. Ibrahim had known bin Laden during the Afghan War, quote, when we were in Afghanistan together, everything was jihad, 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 he says. Here in Sudan, we saw his many other aspects, construction and family life. He was settling down, unquote. I would note, as I'm recording this on December 16th of the year 2001, this past week a videotape of Osama bin Laden was released, and he was, according to the translation of that tape, discussing his knowledge of the construction business and how that enabled him to assess the damage that would be done to the World Trade Center by the burning jet fuel in the aircraft. And I would note the fact that the bin Laden family is a very wealthy construction firm, and that they have a virtual monopoly on construction in Saudi Arabia. We've talked about those connections before. Mohammed bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's father, was a very close personal and professional associate of King Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi state, and himself an individual with strong connections to the underground Reich and, of course, to the petroleum industry. Speaking of the Egyptian connections to Al-Qaeda, skipping down, the Mukhabarat is the Sudanese secret service. In that year, that year being 1994, the Mukhabarat learned that bin Laden had played host for a lengthy visit by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the founder of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, a fundamentalist group behind many armed attacks on Egyptian government ministers and officials, including the 1981 assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat. By the way, I would note in that regard, Ali Mohammed, a double agent on behalf of Al-Qaeda, doubling on not only FBI, but also CIA and apparently military intelligence, was a member of that organization. As a result of the assassination of Anwar Sadat, a company was set up with Turple and Wilson RFA, number four fame, and one of the people involved in that ITSCO company was Frank Carlucci of the Carlyle Group. Skipping down again, speaking of al-Zawahiri and the Egyptian connections to Al-Qaeda, al-Zawahiri, now number two on the FBI's most wanted list, serves as bin Laden's doctor and advisor in Afghanistan. Other Egyptians occupy core positions within the Al-Qaeda network, many of them known to the Mukhabarat since the 1980s. And skipping down again, This will serve as not only an underscore to the information we've just presented, but also some information that will lead to the second side of the broadcast. Listen to what else Osama bin Laden was doing in Sudan. By the way, the Sudanese were at this point trying to exploit international connections to help get their petroleum reserves developed. Note that Osama bin Laden was in Sudan as a construction representative or as a construction supervisor for Saudi financed projects. Not long into the 1990s, Sudan's Islamic fervor was already being tempered by pragmatism. Desperate for investment, especially to develop its vast reserves of oil, the government submitted to the stringent economic medicine prescribed by the World Bank, slashing inflation and privatizing state-owned industries. Osama bin Laden himself became the Sudan agent for the British firm Hunting Surveys, which plays a large role in oil prospecting, and whose military division makes about a fifth of the West's Trident nuclear missiles. In 1994, it tried to assert its anti-terrorist credentials by assisting France in the capture of Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as, quote, Carlos the Jackal, unquote, the notorious Venezuelan-born terrorist who claims to have killed 83 people, now serving a life sentence in France. And, jumping ahead to the present, we're going to take a look at an article from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, December 13th of the year 2001. This particular article is by David Zucchino. It's Dateline Narbonne, France, headlined, "It's as if he had died," unquote, mother of suspect says. That suspect is Zacharias Moussaoui, a French national of Moroccan extraction, who was indicted this past week as a conspirator in the 9/11 attacks. Skipping down in the article, listen to the identity of his French counsel. Zacharias Moussaoui is represented in France by Isabelle Constant Peyre, P-E-Y-R-E, who is well known for representing and later promising to marry Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. As we have seen, his arrest accomplished in part in Sudan by Hunting Services Incorporated employing Osama bin Laden as an agent. And we're going to turn very briefly, and we're going to deal with this at greater length, to the book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. This is by Kevin Coogan, and we're going to hear about an individual who was involved with setting up Carlos's defense in France. This is François Genoux, whom we dealt with in 3-4 the Record 333. Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15th, 1994, skipping down. After his arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Genoux considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. We're going to continue with this fascinating discussion. At least I think it's fascinating on side two of this program, but this concludes side one of For the Record program number 341, The Ties That Bind, part two, being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.